Welcome to the Plastic Podcast. Today we're talking about the summer that just ended in our late summer speed round.
If no one ever told you that bullets fly straight, what would you do?
This is Robert Davis. Well, it's September. The summer has ended. And I don't remember if this was true last summer, but this summer actually had two halves. There was the one that started at the beginning and ended roughly around the middle of the summer. But then there was this other one that started right about where the first one left off and just recently wrapped up. Now, we've already talked about the first half on this podcast. And today we pick up where we left off and talk about The Dark Knight, WALL-E, American Teen, Wanted, about a dozen movies from the second half of the summer. One note, we did record this a couple of weeks ago, almost as if we knew that August was going to be a wasteland at the multiplex. It's not entirely true. There were a couple of exceptions. We'll talk about one of them on the next episode. But for the most part, the big summer movies seem to wrap up fairly early in the summer this time. Joining me, as always, to talk about these movies is J. Robert Parks.
Hey, Rob.
Hey, J. Robert.
How are you?
Good.
Well, a couple weeks ago, one of the biggest movies of the summer, maybe the biggest movie of the summer, opened, The Dark Knight, the Batman sequel. And both critics and audiences have been going gaga over this film. You can't sort of walk into a room without someone wanting to ask me about The Dark Knight and what I think. I noticed yesterday that on IMDb, it is the number one rated movie of all time by IMDb voters. And I was curious whether you think The Dark Knight is the greatest movie ever.
Well, of course. I had to move Late Spring in 2001 down a little bit to make room for Dark Knight. But I think, well, so by the time we got to this point in the summer when The Dark Knight was coming out, I'd had my fill of superhero movies. I think a lot of people had, especially people who've been going to the movies every week. I mean, this is a summer packed with capes and superpowers.
Yep.
And yet, I liked The Dark Knight quite a bit.
Mm.
What did you think of it?
The same. I liked it a lot. Actually, the first hour and a half is probably the most fun I've had in the movies, maybe this calendar year. I was just really enjoying it. I think pretty much every set piece in that first hour and a half is really tight. I think Christopher Nolan does an amazing work with his stunt men and women, and so I was really enjoying it. For me, the last hour loses something, and maybe we can talk about that. But no, I enjoyed it a lot.
It's a very serious and intense mm-hmm. movie, and one of the things I liked about it was that it was willing to question a lot of things that are sort of taken for granted in
yep.
superhero movies, and not just this duality thing, which is sort of the theme of every superhero movie of the guy who puts on a suit and becomes someone else. Well, that's here, but this is also about whether a Batman needs to exist. Mm-hmm. Gotham City has been cleaned up a lot by this guy, and now there's also a district attorney who's mm-hmm. cleaning up, and as Batman himself points out, this guy does it without putting on a mask.
Yep.
And it seems that he wishes or hopes for the day when he doesn't need to be doing this anymore and that we can have a more normal kind of justice. But mm-hmm. at the same time, there are new villains in town. And in fact, they may have been sort of spurred into this theatricality by Batman's theatricality.
Yeah.
And so these are themes that keep, that are popping up like, well, maybe he's not a net good after all.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are interesting things to ask. It's
yeah.
it's just almost a sign of maturity for a superhero movie to ask those things about itself.
I agree. And I'm also intrigued by the fact that the movie wants to ask things about contemporary politics, and so it raises sort of issues of, what if you could sort of use surveillance techniques to track, 3 million people, and what are the goods and bads of giving up civil liberties to go after quote unquote terrorists? I mean, the Joker is actually called a terrorist in the film. And I think the politics of this movie are convoluted. But I'm kind of impressed that the movie tries to do something with that in the context of a superhero movie. And even if I may disagree with some of the choices it makes, or I wish it were maybe a little clearer. Maybe no, I don't wish that, but it's definitely convoluted. There was a piece in the Wall Wall Street Journal last week, where the this author was actually claiming that the movie supports George W. Bush and Batman is George W. Bush. And it's like, okay, I think I wouldn't go there. I think the movie is more balanced than that. But I'm impressed that the movie is trying to deal with those issues.
Yeah, well, I actually agree with that to agree that it supports this idea that maybe sometimes you have to break the mm-hmm. rules and you have to beat the shit out of the guy you're trying to catch in order to get the information out of him. You know, that is what Batman is trying to do, even yep. though he says that he realizes he has to become what he doesn't want to become in order mm-hmm. to beat these guys. And that's part of why he wants to take the mask off and be done with this. Yep. And yet he does. And there are people who say, you know, some of his enablers say, you know what, this is wrong. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to do this anymore.
Yeah.
But I'll do it just this one time.
That's right.
So in some ways, Christopher Nolan is having it both ways. You know, he's saying this sort of thing isn't good, but we need to let Batman do it just this once to take care of this one bad guy. Yep. You know, in some ways, he's not George Bush. He's Dick Cheney, who isn't going to run for re-election anymore for anything and is, you know, and is willing to do the nasty stuff that needs to be done, you know.
Yeah, I'm not going to hold this up as any sort of paragon of liberal politics, but I like the movie, even if I don't always agree with it, is and not over. It's what I'm also impressed by is that these political issues aren't so overt that they're kind of, you know, sometimes I've seen movies where the politics were kind of made you groan. It's like, oh, okay, you know, yeah, you're trying to be contemporary, so you bring up this issue. I thought, you know, the way it's integrated into the plot is actually is pretty seamless. I mean, you don't have long speeches, except in a couple cases near the end that irritated me, but it's worked into the plot in ways that I thought were pretty organic.
Yeah, I feel like the intensity that the movie has and the sort of suspense that develops, it really comes out of these questions. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, Batman should be forced to reveal himself because his presence isn't good.
Yeah.
And now, well, we can't have that. And it just leads to all of these situations that then there are action sequences, of course, and yes. there are things blown up and trucks flipped over and things like that that are pretty yes. cool. But they do come out of this mm-hmm. these questions.
Yeah, the truck flipping over, by the way, is one of the coolest things I've seen in a long time. I think part of the reason I loved that sequence goes back to something we talked about in a couple podcasts ago when we were talking about Indiana Jones, and we talked about sort of the physicality of stunts. And I was curious whether, as you watch The Dark Knight, if you could tell what was going on in the action sequences. When we talked about Indiana Jones, you said one of its virtues was that you could really tell where people were and what was going on.
Yeah.
And I didn't know if you had that experience with The Dark Knight.
No, I think when things really get going, there are times when it's edited in the fast way that mm-hmm. I don't love. Mm-hmm. Lots of times I could. And with that truck sequence, it's important that you know exactly sort of how things are laid out, yeah. at least for a few seconds mm-hmm. anyway, you know.
For me, going back to that discussion, one of the things that I love about The Dark Knight is the sense that it feels like it's real people and real vehicles and real stunts. Batman Begins, the first installment of this installment, was a lot more CGI, particularly in how Chicago was used. And whereas this movie, it really feels like Chicago. I knew exactly where so many of those locations were. And that's kind of fun, just in a, I don't know, a little bit of a thrill, like, oh, that's my city. But also, it helped me. I mean, this chase sequence that leads up to this truck being flipped over happens on a strip of Chicago called Lower Wacker. And I thought that the movie uses Lower Wacker in really interesting ways, this kind of claustrophobic sense of vehicles riding side by side. It reminded me a lot of the car chase scene in Ronin, John Frankenheimer's, you know, amazing car chase towards the end of Ronin, which takes place in the tunnels of Paris. It felt similar to me in ways that I found really exciting. And then to sort of end with the semi-trailer being flipped over on LaSalle Street, at least in the screening I was at, people burst into applause at that moment. And I haven't had that experience in a long time in a movie theater.
What are they applauding? Just the visceral feeling of something crashing to the ground?
Wow, I haven't seen that before. You know, and this kind of sense of, which I can be excited about. I can get behind a really good car chase scene in a action blockbuster. You know, I can get behind, you know, doing a stunt that no one's ever done before. And that's what it felt like that centerpiece of the movie is.
Yeah. At my screening, people whooped when, that motorcycle that Batman rides was able to turn around at a wall. Yeah. You know? It's kind of hard to describe on a podcast, but yeah. It's a sort of neat 3-second move.
Mm-hmm.
Probably one second.
In that sense, for me, one of the things that makes The Dark Knight a really enjoyable film is that it's able to pull off these stunts in ways that I find really gratifying and exciting.
Well, another thing that's unusual about the movie is that it's a really strong ensemble cast.
Yes, it is.
There's a long stretch where Batman isn't on the screen at all, and I didn't miss him. And it's not that I don't like Batman, but there are lots of interesting characters mm-hmm. in this movie. There's Aaron Eckhart, who plays the district attorney,
yep.
who's sort of the new face of justice in the city. There's, of course, Heath Ledger yep. as the Joker, who mm-hmm. everyone is talking about. Gary Oldman plays Gordon, who's a police guy, and he's really good, yeah. And Maggie Gyllenhaal is the love interest. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there's also Michael Caine and
Morgan Freeman,
of course.
But don't discount those guys.
No.
They provide important sort of both stability and comic relief that I think are really important in that film.
Yeah, in my review, I said that they weren't called upon to emerge from the shadows like Harry Lime in The Third Man. You know, they actually had a purpose and a reason for being there, and that was interesting.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. I think it's a great cast. And I think Heath Ledger is great. I mean, he's getting all the publicity and that's fine. There's reasons for that. But, you know, I think Gary Oldman is really incredible in a much less showy role. One of the things that I was impressed, though, by Heath Ledger's performance, and I'm sure this is something that he worked out with Christopher Nolan, is I don't get the sense that the Joker becomes admirable. One of my problems with so many action movies is that sometimes the bad guy, there's a coolness factor to the bad guy, and you end up sort of almost rooting for him. Whereas Heath Ledger's performance is so mannered and so sometimes irritating and so not within the convention of normal bad guys that I almost got the sense that, you know, 15-year-old kids might come out of that movie rooting for Batman, whereas I assumed going in that they'd come out rooting for the Joker.
Well, I don't know. He has this pencil disappearing trick.
Man, that's awesome.
He does these really sadistic things that I think are kind of presented in a cool and funny way sometimes.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that, but I think it's like, I think there's something genuinely, I don't know if you want to use the word subversive, but you know, like when he dresses up in the nurse's uniform and seems almost genuinely scared of what he's about to do. I got the sense that there was an attempt to downplay the coolness factor of the Joker. Whereas like in the Michael Keaton Batman, you know, Jack Nicholson completely upstages Michael Keaton in that film to the point where everyone wanted to be the Joker. I'm not sure everyone wants to be the Joker after this movie.
Well, here's an example of where the characters are one notch richer than they might be in a typical superhero movie. During one of the Joker's sadistic monologues where he's going to carve up someone's face, basically. Yeah. I mean, this is a really violent Joker, not just a funny Joker. But he tells the story of how he got the way he is. Mm-hmm. This terrible thing that happened to him when he was young, you know? And it's not unexpected that that's how characters are explained, you know, in these kinds of movies. But then later he's doing the same thing to someone else and has a completely different story about how he came to be the way. And it sort of echoes his earlier story, but it also echoes more recent events. And you begin to realize that this movie is sort of aware that that's a cliche mm-hmm. in this sort of thing. And even the Joker in this movie is aware of it and is making fun of it, mm-hmm. basically.
No, I agree.
It's an interesting performance because he has this whole sort of gait and mannerisms that are seen even when he's wearing a big, big heavy coat. You know, mm-hmm. you can sort of tell which one is him among lots of people who are dressed similarly in the opening sequence, mm-hmm. which is a bank heist that's really cool, I have to say.
It is.
And this voice, in my review, I described it as a combination of Tom Waits and Al Franken. Now, Tom Waits has like four voices, and the voice I'm talking about is the voice he uses for speaking mm-hmm. in these poems that he recites, you know, the one who says, "What's he building in there? The ocean doesn't want me today." But there's a touch of Al Franken, and I thought I might be the only person to mention this, but Mick LaSalle of the San Francisco Chronicle, he didn't mention Tom Waits, so I'm still at least unique in this combination, but he mentioned that he thought Heath Ledger was doing an impersonation of Al Franken. Oh. I don't think it's quite that.
Interesting. Quite that. I heard another critic, a Chicago-based critic, say that it was probably based on all these Chicago accents Heath Ledger heard when he was here last summer. You know, that it was sort of a distinctly nasally Midwest kind of thing.
I've heard Richard Dreyfuss mentioned.
But no, it's, it, I was genuinely pleased with the film. Now, as I mentioned at the beginning, the movie loses some steam for me in the last hour. And just, I think it feels a little bit repetitive. Like there's certain scenes, particularly certain Joker scenes that are repeated, certain types of encounters or confrontations that get played again and again. And sadly, for me, the weakest of the set pieces is the last one. You know, you would think that you're going to build to something really powerful. And yet I found myself a bit bored with that last set piece and just sort of wanting the movie to end. I know that wasn't true of everyone in the audience, obviously, but for me, it loses a bit of steam there in the last act.
I think he has a little too much going on at several points late in the movie. You know, it's nice to have all these different pieces, but at a certain point, you can't really keep track of them all, and therefore the suspense sort of breaks down. And so I didn't feel the sense of urgency I felt like I was supposed to feel, you know? And there are lots of points like that in the end. Yeah, I think it's not a perfect movie, and it's not a masterpiece, but it's for a superhero film, I thought that it's the best of the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And the second best was Iron Man, and Iron Man is cool and fun in a lot of ways, but this is definitely in a different category.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm at least curious to see what they'll do next. And clearly there's already a third one in the works, and the story sets it up for that. And I'll be looking forward to that.
Now, one of the other most loved films of the summer so far is the new Pixar movie, WALL-E.
It's rightly so, by the way, most loved. I was with friends last night, and one of the couples had seen the movie, and so we were raving about it together, and the other couple was saying, yeah, but it's just a kid's movie. And we were trying to convince them that it was, like so many Pixar movies, so much more than a kid's movie. It is a film, in case you don't know what it's about. It's about a robot named WALL-E, who has been left on planet Earth to help clean up planet Earth, along with many other robots. But those other robots seem to have all broken down over time, and so WALL-E is completely alone and has created this world for himself based on things that he collects as he goes around picking up trash. And the first, I don't know, half hour of the film or 20 minutes, I can't remember because I was sort of lost in the magic of it all, is just watching WALL-E go around Earth and seeing what kind of robot he is. Because, of course, this being a Pixar film, he's very anthropomorphic. He's very human. I told a friend that I thought WALL-E was the most human movie of the summer. And WALL-E is definitely that. But then at a certain point in the movie, this other robot named Eve shows up, a much more modern robot, a much more less, I don't want to say less human, but not as human maybe as WALL-E. And then the movie is about their relationship. And then about halfway through, that shifts to a different locale. But still, the core of the movie is about them. And it's just delightful. It's amazing how the Pixar folks and director Andrew Stanton are able to use sort of silent movie techniques, I think, you know, because there's very little dialogue in the film. But yet able to create such rich characters and such a rich mise-en-scene and such rich storylines that I just loved it. I thought it was really, really wonderful.
I feel like Pixar has such a great track record that we expect a good movie from them, but they've made these good movies in a fairly narrow range. You know, we sort of know what they're good at. And WALL-E moves outside of that comfort zone a little
bit.
How so? Well, just the first 45 minutes have almost no dialogue. I mean, that's pretty unusual. Granted, it doesn't take, you know, a huge leap outside of their comfort zone because, as you said, the creature is still anthropomorphic and cute in the ways that Pixar creatures are cute. But I love the way, in all of their movies, but in here too, it feels like 100 people have spent years working hard, thinking creatively to tell a story that's really simple.
Yeah.
And tell a story that kids can understand.
Yeah.
And the first 45 minutes I especially loved about WALL-E. Mm-hmm. It becomes conventional after that, which I think is a little disappointing, only because the first half is really so good. The second half is fine, but it's sort of more what you'd expect from an animated movie of the summer. You know, there's more action and things sort of have to wrap up in a quick and fun way. And, but that first 45 minutes is just sort of little objects on Earth. And I guess the Earthlings, the humans, us, you know, we've left the Earth behind and gone up into space, but left some creatures behind to clean it up. But now 700 years have passed. And so That's more than was expected, I guess. Yeah. And so now life is up on this ship, and the human life up there is wonderful and terrible at the same time.
Yeah. You
know? But also there are live actors in this movie, something that I don't, certainly I didn't expect, but there are videotapes, that Wally finds of the humans who lived here 700 years ago. Mm-hmm. He watches, a musical and is always, it's from Hello Dolly. Yeah. Yeah. And he loves to replay pieces of that. Just a very lonely image.
Yeah, Pixar has really nailed this sense of, in the spite of making kids movies that are cute and funny, there's always this undercurrent of melancholy about their films. In the Toy Story movies, it was sort of this nostalgia that parents have for their children as they're growing up. Here, the melancholy is the sense of, you know, sort of what are we doing to our planet? But also, what is it like to be alone? And I think the movie really captures that, of this sense of being alone, and how you sometimes, if you're alone, you create your own kind of world. And I really like that about, like you say, the first 45 minutes of how you get to know Wally and feel that sense of aloneness, so that when Eve shows up, you understand, you know, how desperate he is to hold on to something that is like him.
Yeah. Although she turns out to have, you know, a real laser fist at first. It's a while to warm up to.
Wally. So that's part of the humor in those initial scenes is, you know, he expects her to be one way, and actually we expect her to be one way, and then she is very, very different. Yeah, a laser fist is fun. But I agree that it loses a bit when it becomes more conventional. I understand why it's going there. And that's actually been a problem for me in a lot of Pixar films, is as much as I love the way they construct these worlds, sometimes the last act has to revolve around some sort of chase sequence. And that feels always a bit, I don't know, I don't want to say redundant, but just not up to the rest of the film. And that's true here.
Yeah, and maybe that's just, it's a little more obvious this time because the first half is so different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
So this summer, you've also caught up with a couple of movies that I saw earlier this year.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
Man on Wire.
Yeah, Man on Wire. I just saw that about a week ago, and it's as good as you said it was. I remember you saw it at Sundance, and it's this documentary about Philippe Petit, who walked across the chasm between the top of the World Trade Center towers in 1974. And so the movie is basically just interviews with him and a lot of the people who helped him, because it was a fairly large team of people who helped him prepare for this conquest and helped them then get up to the top of the towers and string this wire from one tower to the next.
In secret.
Yes,
they weren't invited to do this.
Yes, no. And there was a lot they had to do to sort of get around the security that existed. And then on one August morning, Petit just walks out into thin air, and the movie, like you'd said before, Rob, is really there's a tension about it, even though I remember that scene or I remember the reading the news accounts of it, so I knew whether he succeeds or not, and of course you know that from the very first minute because we're interviewing him 30 years later, but still there's this strange tension that builds as you're wondering, you know, how they're going to do this and whether they're going to be caught, and I don't know, it's kind of weird to know what's going to happen yet still feel tension about it, but no, I thought it was really strong.
It's also an interesting engineering problem. You know, how would you, even if you had permission and didn't have to sneak around, how would you string a wire across the tops of two buildings, you know, from one to the other?
Yeah.
It's complicated.
Yeah. For me, there were a couple things that I wish were a little bit different about the film. And this isn't really the filmmaker's fault. James Marsh does, I think, a really great job with the material he has. But he has a lot of footage of this team preparing. They must have had a film camera and they sort of filmed themselves as they were getting ready. And yet there's very little actual footage of the walk across the World Trade Center itself. You know, we have certain photographs and those kind of just get repeated over and over again. And it feels a bit, I don't know, anticlimactic isn't quite the right word, but I just wish there was more footage of what this high wire walk was like.
Yeah.
So, and then I also saw Baghead, another movie that you had praised highly at Sundance. And again, we're in lockstep on these. I thought that was really fun. And it's, I was telling someone that it's the first movie I've had in quite a while where I honestly had no idea what was going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, there's moments in this film where it's like, I have no idea where we're going. And that was really exciting.
Well, I caught up with a movie that you saw earlier this year, or actually, I guess you saw it last year at Toronto.
That's right.
It's Werner Herzog's latest movie, Encounters at the End of the World. When I talked to him on an earlier episode of this podcast, he mentioned that he was going to be using this footage that he got from his friend Henry Kaiser, who's a diver and shoots this amazing stuff under the ice in Antarctica, that he was going to be using that in his next movie. And it turns out he went down there and just interviewed people who are living in Antarctica. You know, they're scientists or they're people studying various things. They'll have a reason to be there. But he likes the idea of someone who would, you know, face the elements like that, because it's something that he does, I think. You know, he doesn't do it with ice normally. He's in the jungle. But he's always had this sort of adversarial relationship with nature, yeah, and seems fascinated to find that conflict in other people. And here he does that too. Mm-hmm. And it's a fun movie. And mm-hmm. he definitely, as he says at the very beginning, he was worried that he got money for this from the National Science Foundation because he had to be upfront with them and tell them he wasn't going to come back with a movie about penguins. And the one penguin sequence in this is a significantly darker penguin sequence than March of the Penguins. But yeah, his view that nature is out to murder us sort of pervades, yeah, all of his commentary. He's not actually seen in this movie, but he's interviewing people and commenting on what they're saying and cutting them short sometimes, saying, her story was very boring. Her story went on forever. I sort of felt a little bit the way I felt about Guy Madden's new movie, My Winnipeg, which is also playing in some cities, which is, it's enjoyable. Because all of Guy Madden's movies and all of Werner Herzog's movies are enjoyable for their particular quirks, but that it was a movie where he wasn't necessarily working as hard as he has maybe for some other movies. You know, he assembled these sort of interesting little vignettes of people, and it was fun to see life down there through his lens. And there was some really just some amazing, you know, footage and view of stuff I've never seen. These weird formations that form in the ice and under the ice, creatures that live under there. Some of which is in his previous movie, The Wild Blue Yonder,
which I haven't seen.
There's actually even more underwater footage in that than I think there is in Encounters at the End of the World.
It's, for me, I maybe like the film a little bit more, in part because I like Herzog's contrarian position on nature. And, you know, and his contempt for March of the Penguins is so evident in this movie. And I just find that really funny, even though I kind of like that movie, just the fact that Herzog hates it makes me laugh. But also some of the nature stuff is unbelievably beautiful. The undersea diving photography they got is just awesome. And so the movie's worth seeing even for that, even if you don't necessarily agree with Herzog's approach or perspective.
Now, aside from the stuff that Henry Kaiser shot under the water, I believe Herzog may have shot this himself. There wasn't another cameraman listed, and since he's not seen, I wonder if maybe he was operating the camera. Could
be. Good point. I don't know.
Could be. Now, the title, Encounters at the End of the World, almost sounds like a superhero movie.
Yeah.
It almost sounds like one of these earth-shaking kind of big blockbusters, of which there have been plenty. Another one, for example, is Will Smith's movie Hancock. Did you see that one?
I did. And well, I certainly wouldn't compare it to Dark Knight, but it's not bad. At least I didn't think it was bad. I think Will Smith is always charismatic, and here he is in this movie. He's playing the movie has a nice twist, at least at the beginning, in that it's, you know, Will Smith is playing this alienated superhero, this guy who doesn't feel like he's appreciated by the world and therefore has, you know, decided to drop out despite his superpowers. And that's, I think that's an interesting twist on the whole genre. But of course, then the movie has to spend a lot of time talking about how he's rehabilitated, and Jason Bateman plays this PR guy who might be the worst PR guy ever, but who has this dream of you know, using the power of public relations to make Will Smith a better man. And of course, then Will Smith has to become a better man. And Charlize Theron has, who plays Jason Bateman's wife, for the first 2/3 of the movie does nothing except have miserable reaction shot after miserable reaction shot. And so I'm thinking, wow, they paid her a lot of money just to do that. And then in the last third of the movie, you understand what she's doing, although the movie telegraphs that way earlier than that. But anyway, it's not bad. It's not good, but it's not bad.
Yeah, I really liked the idea, even though it's something I think we've seen before, like in The Incredibles, for example, of superheroes who have been sued into reclusion. This guy, though, he's drunk and he's sleeping on park benches. He doesn't look like someone who'd be solving a lot of crimes and doesn't particularly want to, it seems.
No,
he's
no.
reckless. He's wrecking things all over the place. I really liked that idea. It's a little bit like Mystery Men or The Tick,
mm-hmm.
these sort of comical movies about the lower class of superheroes. When he starts flying at one point, we hear the theme from Sanford and Son.
Oh.
I don't know if you remember that part, but that's the type of superhero we're dealing with. I kind of liked that idea, but it really seems to run out of steam after half an hour, and they're like, gosh, we don't know where to take this. Let's shift to something else.
Yeah.
And you're right that the presence of Charlize Theron is a clue that you wouldn't hire such a big actress for such a tiny role. So we'll say no more, but...
What do you think of Hellboy, another sort of alienated superhero movie?
Well, this is Hellboy 2.
Ah, indeed.
I didn't see Hellboy, but I sort of became interested in Guillermo del Toro, the director, writer and director of this film, because of Pan's Labyrinth, the movie that he made.
He's a Mexican filmmaker,
But he's done a lot of work in Hollywood, making movies like Hellboy and The Devil's Backbone.
Right, which is a Spanish film.
Oh, okay.
But then he also did Mimic, and he actually did one of the Blade movies. Actually.
Okay.
So he tends to go back and forth between doing sort of more arty Spanish language films and doing sort of Hollywood big films.
Yeah. Well, this was a sequel, so I didn't have context going into it, but I sort of picked up pretty quickly that these are sort of aliens who, you know, they kind of try to solve crimes, I guess. I'm not sure they solve crimes, but anyway, they're sort of here for good. They're not bad aliens.
Yeah.
Hellboy... he's sort of big and strong, but
and red.
And red. He has some horns that are sawed off.
And he has a big hand.
He has a very big hand that looks like a glove, like a hockey glove or something.
Yeah, oh, actually, that's right. Okay.
But it was fine. There was a sequence that reminded me of something from Princess Mononoke, which was pretty cool, this really big creature that they're dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just Hellboy, but he has sort of a band of friends who are with him. There's a guy who looks a little bit like a fish, and there's a guy who seems to be leading the group who's just a gas. it sounds strange, but these are sort of the fantastic things that Guillermo del Toro comes up with. And I can appreciate that to a certain degree, but also I feel like it's fairly lightweight. After a while, I'm thinking, I'm not sure this movie's really for me, but I can see that maybe someone who's into this would like it. But then I started wondering, who is this movie for? because it's not really a kid's movie, and yet it's definitely in this sort of fantastic world. And I thought that same thing about Pan's Labyrinth, but there was this path I could take to rationalizing that.
Yeah.
In Pan's Labyrinth, the story is about this little girl who's in Franco's Spain, and there's war around her constantly, and her family's torn apart. And so the way she sort of deals with the world is by imagining this fantasy world inside it. And so the fantastical elements and fairies and fauns that are within the story reflects a character in the story. And so even though this is a really violent movie that's not for kids, it's for adults, but there's a reason that it's told through fantasy. Mm-hmm. Where this is really just, I guess, for people who are adults but still love those old comic books they had stuffed away in the closet or something.
Yeah, or want sort of, you know, a Lord of the Rings kind of fantasy, but a little bit lighter. Or not lighter in tone, but, you know, not as rich.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really like Del Toro's work in general. My favorite is still one of the earlier movies he made called The Devil's Backbone. Remember when I saw him talk in Toronto about Pan's Labyrinth, he said that Pan's Labyrinth was the little girl's movie that was a counterpoint to the little boys of The Devil's Backbone. Because that movie also has sort of fantastical elements, but there it's a ghost story, also set in the Civil War in Franco's Spain. And there's this really rich aspect to that film, although it's also really violent, about thinking about violence and thinking about the ghosts that haunt you in the midst of violence. And so Pan's Labyrinth for me was a continuation of that in interesting ways. And Hellboy 2 is Del Toro just having a big budget and being able to sort of let this imagination run wild. And so for me, the best parts of the film are just sort of watching all these creatures he imagines. But the story itself feels pretty thin. And strangely, the characters I'm supposed to root for, I don't care much about. I like Ron Perlman as an actor. He plays Hellboy. And I thought he was quite a bit better in the first movie at sort of playing this alienated hero. Here he just seems like he's a little bit petulant, you know, like he'd much rather just, you know, be watching TV somewhere. And after a while, I kind of thought to myself the same thing. Yeah, I wish I was kind of watching TV somewhere.
Yeah, one thing I did like about the creatures was I can't remember the name of the one who looks a little bit like a fish.
Abe.
I was surprised at how clear a personality he had, mm-hmm. considering his face doesn't really change. He has no facial expressions other than the one that's sort of fixed. But he has this sort of delicate voice and mm-hmm. something about the way the actor moves. Maybe it's also that the character listens to Barry Manilow. it helps round mm-hmm. him out a little bit. But I thought it was a fine silly movie.
A movie that I think I like a little bit more than you is a documentary called American Teen, which is, it's a movie about teenagers, a documentary, where the director, Nanette Burstein, went to this little town of Warsaw, Indiana, and found about 8 to 10 different teenagers that she wanted to follow over the course of the year, which she then narrows down to 5 or 6 sort of key figures. But what she was looking for, and intentionally so, and I think this is where some people have a problem with it, is she was looking for sort of almost stereotypes. You know, she's looking for the jock, she was looking for the queen bee, she was looking for the kind of the outcast and the geek, and just sort of following them over the course of the year, creating this portrait of not American teenagers, that's marketing, that's not actually what she's setting out to do, but this portrait of at least teenagers in this small town and what they struggle with and what they hope for and what they fear. And I have a soft spot for movies about teenagers, and so just because I've worked with them for so long. And I found the movie in that way to be satisfying, but I know that you don't like it quite as much.
Well, it was a movie that when I came out of it at Sundance, I think it was maybe the last movie I saw there this year, I felt like, yeah, that was a fun way to end. But then, you know, as I drifted further from it and thought more about the movie, I liked it less and less, partly because it's a really reductive view of, even pick any small town, it's more varied than the people that are here. This is a very familiar set of 4 people, and yet it's excludes, you know, the world practically. and a lot of this has been made about whether this is really a documentary or not, because people receive text messages and we instantly get a cutaway to see exactly what was on that text message. Somehow we're able to see that. Somehow we're able to hear phone calls that are made. Mm-hmm. We're able to attend all the important events. You know, it's clearly manipulated. I don't think that I have a problem with any of that, unless someone is going to take this as the truth or mm-hmm. reportage or something. That's just how movies work.
Yep.
This is a story.
Lots of documentaries work that way.
Yeah. And in some sense, it doesn't matter whether, you know, trying to define documentary is mm-hmm. actually very, very difficult to do. But one thing,
particularly in this age of reality TV.
Well, one thing that interests me about this movie, though, is that it's a story that was almost, I realize the director sort of had final control over how she chose the people and how she edited them into a movie. But also the people who are playing those characters, they're playing themselves or versions of themselves. They sort of know the story that she wants to tell also. And so what we're seeing is almost a collective story told by a group of people who know this story already, as we in the audience do.
I was curious, do you think it's they know the story she wants to tell, or do they know the story that films always tell about teenagers?
I think those are probably the one and the same.
Because mm-hmm. I think, I agree, but I think that's an important distinction in this way. One of the things that I find fascinating about the film is that, I'm not sure how smart the film is about this, but I found it interesting, is how the camera changes things, you know, how the camera moves kids in certain ways and how you can tell that it's changing the way they're acting. Sometimes the teenagers are almost oblivious of the camera in ways that I found really strange. It was like, hold on, don't you realize you're being filmed? Do you really want to talk about that or act like that? But then other times, clearly the camera affects their behavior. You know, there's a couple times in which the Jacob, who's the quintessential geek, you know, gets up the nerve to ask girls out. And you can almost tell that he's doing it because the camera's there, right? I mean, that's what he's supposed to do. And I found that interesting. I think that the movie is, even if it's not smart enough to do this on its own, hopefully the audience is smart enough to start asking the question of, okay, what would it mean to, you know, have someone following you for 8 months of your senior year? How would that change what you did and didn't do, and how are so much of teen life today, particularly in reality TV age, all about performance. And I think that that's what some of the things that I really like about the film.
Yeah, there were two previous movies that this made me think of. Of course, it feels like reality TV. Yeah. It's sort of like one big long special episode of a TV show that doesn't really exist. But there was a series very early on, not quite as early as The Real World on MTV, but in the very early stages of this reality TV boom, by R.J. Cutler, called American High. And it sort of...
But on PBS?
Well, it shifted around and it ended up on PBS and Fox, I believe, both. But it was a miniseries that just ran for, I think, 13 episodes or something like that. But what they did is they gave cameras to a bunch of different students and they asked them to film their lives. And then they also did interview footage and their own separate footage and combined it into these portraits similar to American Teen of, you know, this type of person, this type of person. Because they had a little bit... they had more time, they could go into more characters. But it's still sort of... was telling familiar stories the same way that this is. But the other movie that this made me think of, which is related to the comments you just made, was a documentary called Paradise Lost, The Child Murders of Robin Hood Hills.
Which I haven't seen.
It's about this terrible murder of these kids that were killed in Arkansas, I believe.
I think that's right.
But it was a horrible murder, and some older kids were blamed for it because they were sort of into... you know, goth dress and music and stuff. And the movie takes the position that they were unfairly blamed for this, that it wasn't really clear from the evidence that they were involved at all. But what's interesting to me about the movie, aside from the sort of interest of the mystery, is that when the filmmakers go to interview parents, for example, they're very theatrical. They behave in a way that they feel they're supposed to behave on camera. Mm-hmm. You know, there's rending of garments and horrible theatrical crying. And of course, it's a terrible situation. And I don't mean to make light of how they must have felt really, but this is many months later and now there's a camera crew there. And it feels like they're recreating this and telling these monologues because that's what happens on Jerry Springer. Yeah. You know, this is many years ago that this movie was made. And so in some ways, I don't know that any of us behaves, you know, we don't behave independent of TV.
No.
We all sort of know how we behave socially because of the other people we see around us.
Yep.
And a lot of the people we see around us, we see on TV. And so a lot of our behavior, even if there isn't a camera present, is probably moving toward these magnetic poles that have been created by the stories themselves, you know, that everything's sort of self-reinforcing.
Yeah.
I think the director here also reinforces the story she wants to tell. You know, she really wants that girl to be a bitch. And she really wants her maybe to sort of turn over a new leaf, but then to turn out to really be a bitch after all. Why? Because we know that's how she really is, you know? I feel like I don't know these kids in this movie at all, but it's kind of fun to see their lives shaped into a story. I certainly wouldn't want to do that, and I would hope that no one would do that to me. But assuming they're willing participants, it's kind of fun to see how that happens.
Yeah, I agree. Another movie you saw at Sundance, which is finally making its release, is the film called The Whackness, which I haven't seen. So what's The Whackness about?
It's another teen movie. This is about, you know, I'm not even sure I want to spend much time talking about this one.
Oh, okay. Oh, too bad it was a nice segue, but that's fine. We don't have to.
it was such a good segue, I'll say something. Yeah, this is a movie that it takes place in the 90s. And you know that because every 5 minutes they tell you this takes place in the 90s.
Do people actually have fondness for the 90s? I feel old now.
I think so. Yeah. I think so.
All my friends have fondness for the 80s, which also mystifies me a bit. But
The other funny thing, I guess, is that Sir Ben Kingsley is in this as a psychiatrist who likes to get high. And as
don't
this,
they all?
What's that?
Don't they all?
Well, he has an arrangement with one of his students who sells pot.
Oh,
And so that convenient. He'll provide free. Yes, exactly. They have this perfectly mutual situation going. And he has long hair. Is Ben Kingsley still a serious actor? I'm trying to remember if Ben Kingsley's still a serious actor.
You know, he's in all these movies this year. I saw a trailer for him with Elegy. So he's in Elegy, which is coming out now. But then I saw... another movie coming out down the road. I think he's doing a lot of these same parts where, you know, kind of quirky.
He was in The Love Guru. He was in Lucky Number 11.
Oh, very good.
A lot of these are, you know, if part of the charge is to see, whoa, that's Sir Ben Kingsley in this crazy role with long hair making out with Mary-Kate Olsen, It only goes so far. he got a couple chuckles from me, but otherwise, no, it's not worth it.
A lot of people like that film, though. What's the appeal, do you think?
It's the kind of movie that I can see why people like it, because these 90s references can be fun to chuckle at.
If
you remember them.
It's a Simpsons style of humor then.
Yeah.
It's like I catch the pop culture reference, you know, ergo I am cool.
Exactly. And there's also something kind of fun about seeing an adult behave like a 14-year-old.
Oh, except that's become the norm. And you know, I haven't seen Step Brothers, but, you know, apparently it's, you know, adults behaving like 10-year-olds. And, you know, pretty much every Judd Apatow comedy out there is, you know, arrested development of some kind.
Yeah. Yeah. It also has a really, Olivia Thirlby is in it, and she's, of course, really cute. She was Juno's friend, mm-hmm. and it's shot in this really attractive, sexy-looking way. Mm. And I think it has this sort of general quality look, although it's really too green. The picture's just too green. I'm so going to cut that out of this podcast.
Movie that I've seen that you haven't seen is at least somewhat better, a French thriller called Tell No One. Directed by Guillaume Canet. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. But he's actually more an actor, but he's directed a few movies. And this one's a pretty straight-ahead thriller. This man, he's a Alex Beck, is a pediatrician, a very loved pediatrician, as they all are, of course. And the opening sequence is of him, you know, madly in love with his wife, who seems much younger than him, but apparently they were childhood friends. I guess only in the movies. And... but then she's killed, sort of mysteriously. And then you cut forward 8 years later when he actually gets a message that seems to be from her. And so then plot goes in motion. You know, he's trying to find out, is his wife still alive? Why is she, if she's still alive, why can't she see him? Where has she been for 8 years? Blah, 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 blah. The movie feels, I'm sure there is an American remake just around the corner, because the film has this really sort of convoluted but interesting plot that if you think about it too hard, is like, hold on, that doesn't make any sense. But it does have a crackerjack middle act. The beginning, I don't care much so much for. The end is way too much exposition, people explaining what's, you know, should they go on forever and ever talking about what's happened. But the middle part of this film is actually pretty, pretty exciting. So it's not, if you're in the mood for, you know, kind of a French thriller that makes you think, but not terribly hard, Tell No One is not a bad choice.
I have one that is a bad choice.
Oh, what's that?
It's called Wanted.
Ah, another thriller, but not a French thriller. Although Angelina Jolie is spending a lot of time in France.
Is she?
Yeah, apparently so.
So this is a movie about a fraternity of assassins.
Mm.
And Angelina Jolie is in this fraternity.
Do they have special ways of killing people? Like, does each one have a certain thing that he does really well?
Well, see, before I went to this, I thought, well, at least it's not another comic book movie.
Okay.
But it turns out it is. It is a comic book movie, superhero. The superpowers that these people have is they can flip cars really accurately.
Hmm.
So you can hit a bump and flip in such a way that you are aiming exactly where you need to go next.
Excellent.
It's
excellent.
Very, yeah, it's a good skill to have.
Uh-huh.
And also you can really take a pummeling. If you're one of these guys, because they have this vat of wax that they sit in at the end of each day that heals all wounds. It doesn't seem... You think I'm making this up. The wax knows not to take away Angelina Jolie's tattoos, luckily.
Excellent.
However, excellent. It heals other abrasions.
Excellent.
Now, James McAvoy is this office worker who's in a dead-end job.
Mm.
Seems like he'd be much cooler if he were in a fraternity of assassins.
Well, he'd at least have a chance with Angelina Jolie, I suspect.
But what he really should be doing instead, in my opinion, is finding out where they get the wax, because that would be a lot more useful than just being a part of the fraternity of assassins. The fraternity of assassins takes all of its instructions from a loom of fate, which tells them who to kill next.
Excellent.
But they're killing for good. They're killing people who, if they weren't killed, would lead to many more deaths. So this is a preemptive strike.
Dick Cheney?
Exactly. And you must be careful. Morgan Freeman is the guy who reads the Loom of Fate. And I was disappointed to see him appear, because up until he appears, this seems like a really low rent kind of movie.
Yeah.
But he comes on and delivers every dumb piece of dialogue with perfection. He can sell any piece of dialogue.
Yes, he can.
However, be careful of that, because he's the one reading the Loom of Fate.
There's no twists in Get Smart. I should say this. I have a soft spot for Get Smart just because it has such a great cast. Steve Carell plays, you know, the new version of Maxwell Smart, and he seems like he was born to play that role. Anne Hathaway, who I think is smoking hot, is Agent 99, and by the way, particularly hot in this film. But then you've also got Alan Arkin as the chief. You've got Terrence Stamp as the bad guy, and I can watch Alan Arkin and Terrence Stamp, and they could read the phone book, and I think that'd be exciting. And we've got, you know, Dwayne The Rock Johnson, who actually has a lot of comic talent, and so you have this great cast in the service of miserable, miserable script. And in miserable direction as well. And so I know some people really hated this movie. I didn't hate the movie until the end. The end doesn't do it at all for me. But for a while, I was kind of grooving on it. Just, you know, there's some bad jokes, but there's some good jokes. And I was enjoying watching this cast sort of take apart the material and do the best they could with it. But then the last half hour becomes this ridiculous chase set piece thing that's in no way convincing and loses all the charm that the movie had built up sort of beforehand. But anyway, what'd you think?
Yeah, I guess we can blame Ghostbusters for being the first big special effects comedy. Mm-hmm. But you know, the things I remember about Ghostbusters are the funny lines, you know, don't look at the trap. I looked at the trap, Ray. I looked at the trap. You know, there are tons of those things from Ghostbusters that I remember, but Men in Black, I don't really remember anything. I think Johnny Knoxville's head is on some sort of a creature at some point. And this feels like that to me. There are lots of special effects with these gadgets that are supposed to be kind of funny, but I feel like they sort of kill any momentum that might have developed. And comedy is all about timing, it seems. And so if you're concocting it all in an editing room or with special effects folks, they need to have the sense of timing too, and it all has to make sense. And except for a couple of moments here and there, I just didn't feel like I was laughing very much and didn't care much about, you know, a cone of silence that looks kind of cool, but isn't that funny.
Yeah.
You know?
It's amazing to me how often there'll be scenes in Get Smart where there actually are some funny jokes. At least I found them funny. But then the scene ends with the worst joke of them all. So you have what should be the, you know, the kind of the, you know, dun-dun moment in the scene, and it just falls, you know, flat. Every single time, every single scene ends with this horrible empty groan, and it just sort of ruins everything that might have worked in that scene. I got really frustrated with that. The director is a guy, I actually forget his name, but I wrote down the movies he's done because they're this like holy trinity of awfulness. He's did The Longest Yard, he did Nutty Professor 2, and he did Anger Management. You know, those might be three of the worst comedies of the last dozen years, so it's no surprise that this one doesn't quite work either.
Yeah. Well, Eddie Murphy has a new movie also, and it's called Meet Dave.
Speaking of Nutty Professor.
Yeah. You might think that this belongs in that category, but this is really just a movie for kids, and so I don't think it's worth getting worked up over. A lot of people have been trashing this movie, I think, but you know, for the right age, this is probably fine. Mm-hmm. It's a silly movie about this ship that lands on Earth, and it looks like Eddie Murphy, and it walks around sort of like a robot, and inside are these tiny little people who control it, sort of like they're in the Starship Enterprise or something, but really they're in this thing. And most of the humor comes from him not knowing how to shake hands with people that he meets on the street, and none of it makes any sense at all. But you know, on this level of, oh, it's funny that he can't figure out how to say hello to someone, you know, that's the level of humor we're talking about. It's inoffensive and simple and dumb. But I happened to see this shortly after seeing WALL-E, and it really struck me how different these two approaches are to making movies for kids. You know, Pixar seems to just labor over every little detail and really value creativity, even though it's for kids, where this is a movie that was thrown away for kids. And I don't think that that means kids won't enjoy it. They probably will. I don't think many adults will. And I don't think there's anything necessarily of lasting value. But it's just a remarkably different approach.
And I think too that with WALL-E, there's not an attempt to dumb down the material. You know, there's no attempt to sort of talk down to kids. And so with so many of Pixar films, there's this belief that you can tell a very simple story, but if you tell it so well and with such conviction, that both kids and adults will come along with you. And for most Pixar films, that's true. I was, again, going back to this conversation I had just yesterday, you know, I was telling this couple, no, I think you'll really like it. I mean, you don't have to take along your nieces and nephews. You can just go on your own and enjoy the wonder of WALL-E. Whereas with so many kids movies, you know, Meet Dave, apparently, there's just no way that adults could really fasten on to it unless, you know, they're being dragged along by their seven-year-olds.
Yeah.
Well, one last movie we've seen, which is definitely not for kids. Mac, it's hard for me to imagine that Hunter S. Thompson was ever a child. Although the documentary Gonzo, The Life and Work of Dr. Hunter S. Thompson, deals a little bit with his childhood. But mostly it's a movie about the journalist's work, particularly in the mid-60s and early to mid-70s. If you're not familiar with Hunter S. Thompson, he was a famous freelance journalist, did a lot of work for Rolling Stone. Wrote Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail, probably his best, greatest book. But this is a pretty standard issue documentary directed by Alex Gibney, who did the Enron movie and also did Taxi to the Dark Side, where, you know, he sort of looks back over Hunter S. Thompson's career and interviews a whole bunch of people. And Johnny Depp, who is a huge fan, sort of comes along and reads parts of Thompson's work. And we see archival footage of Thompson, who, by the way, committed suicide a couple of years ago. So all the footage of him is just old footage, but then footage interviews with his first wife and his second wife and various people who knew him, like John Venner of Rolling Stone. What do you think, Rob?
I thought it was pretty good. And I'm someone who knows the story of Hunter S. Thompson, but I never actually read anything by mm-hmm. him. And this movie, the thing I like most about this movie is that it made me want to go track down something and read mm-hmm. it. And so I read Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail, 1972.
And how does it fit what you expected it to be?
Yeah, it's just a lot of fun. And the interesting thing about reading it now, at the same time that I was sort of flipping through Rick Perlstein's Nixon Land,
yeah.
is how these prior eras are echoed today. You know, so many of the things that Thompson was writing about in this presidential campaign that you'd think would be, you know, irrelevant to mm-hmm. now, because it's all these sort of also-rans. It's mm-hmm. people who didn't end up becoming president. You know, he's yeah. covering McGovern.
By the way, it's the 1972 election. So it's the election that Nixon won over McGovern. So.
Yeah, yeah. And so he's covering Muskie and McGovern and these people who are no longer on the scene. And yet the themes of how we're going to get out of Vietnam and whether whether the left people who are against the war enough mm-hmm. and the way they're manipulating their images. And of course their image making isn't as sophisticated as now, but it's interesting how all of this was going on even then. Mm-hmm. And I think one thing the movie does is it sort of makes you wish that there was a Hunter S. Thompson now mm-hmm. covering the scene. I think in some ways that's wishful thinking. One of the ways that Thompson was able to do this is he was unexpected.
Mm-hmm.
Now everyone is sort of giving their own novelized opinion of yeah. what's going on, and it's, you know, you can read a blog anywhere,
yeah.
and so it's kind of more standard. But he definitely did it with more panache
mm-hmm.
and more determination and more drugs and alcohol
yes.
than most people are doing it today. One thing I didn't care for about the movie was that there are some reenactments that sort of try to set the scene of things they don't have footage for. They have a fair amount of footage for when he was running for mayor of Aspen, Colorado, which was very funny, on the freak power ticket.
Mm.
But they have a lot of reenactments that at times isn't clear what's reenacted and what isn't. Like, especially early on, they have an audio recording that is real. And they've made this reenactment that looks sort of like Super 8 home movies. And at first I thought, oh, we have a home movie of this too. And then I begin to realize, oh, no, wait, they put this new footage with this audio. And I think they were sort of purposely trying to blur the lines of fact and fiction the way Thompson did. But this is a pet peeve of mine, is that documentarians don't have to adopt the style of the thing they're documenting.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it would have been clearer if they hadn't done that.
Yeah.
But in all, I liked this movie a lot as someone who doesn't know the details of Thompson's life. And I know people who are more familiar with sort of his later period when he was not as good a writer or seemed less relevant or almost seemed like he had peaked early on. Felt like that isn't covered as much in this film, maybe because they don't want to dwell on that. You know?
Yeah, it's not as exciting a story for sure.
Yeah.
I don't like the movie quite as much. I do think it's a helpful introduction to Hunter S. Thompson. I'm in sort of the same boat that you were in that. I know of him, but I hadn't really read much of him. And so for me, the best parts of the film are giving a sense of how he wrote or what he wrote, as well as the longest sequence in the movie focuses on the 1972 election. And I thought Gibney does a really nice job of using archival footage of that period and making these sort of allusions to contemporary events. The movie certainly is about the 60s and 70s, but Gibney's smart enough to, you know, if we're paying attention, we can think about how this is relevant to the last, you know, 5-6 years and how Iraq is like Vietnam or not like Vietnam. And so I liked that a lot. But there are certain things about the film that irritate me. The musical choices irritate me to no end. It's just this sort of greatest hits of the 60s and 70s.
American Pie.
You know, just freaking, you know, bring out every single cliche. You know, yeah, we've got to have Rolling Stone Sympathy for the Devil. We've got to, it's just irritating. And the movie's smart enough that it's like, why are we doing this? We don't need this sort of stock musical choices. But also the movie, I think, is also a little bit stock, and it's become very common in documentaries that when you're dealing with an admired but flawed figure, you have to have, you know, most of the people love our admired figure, but we have to trot out the couple of people who will say, yeah, but he had some problems too. And the movie just feels very calculated in that sense. You know, we're not really going to talk about, you know, what a guy Hunter S. Thompson was, except to sort of say, yeah, he wasn't perfect. But here, look what a great guy he was anyway. And I find that approach just a bit too familiar, I think.
Yeah, I did like seeing what Patrick Buchanan and Jimmy Carter, mm-hmm. for example, or McGovern had to say now in contemporary interviews, had to say about Hunter S. Thompson. Mm-hmm. That was kind of unexpected.
Yeah, and I wish there had been maybe, I don't know, a little bit more of that, or I'm not quite sure what I want, but it felt just a bit too calculated for me.
Yeah.
But it's still worthwhile, and particularly if you don't know anything. I think Keith Phipps in The Onion said it best. You know, it's sort of an introduction to Hunter S. Thompson for people who don't actually know him. And that's probably fair.
Well, that's going to do it for this edition of the Plastic Podcast. Still getting used to saying that. We've changed the name of the podcast because we've changed the home of the podcast. You can find us on the web at dailyplastic.com. And there you'll also find all kinds of other stuff that we're doing pretty much, you know, daily, as you might guess. Reviews, reports from the Toronto International Film Festival kicking in real soon, and more stuff on the way. We'll be back next time with a couple of interviews. If you have comments or feedback for this podcast, we'd love to hear it. If you'd like to tell us what you think of these movies or tell us what you think of this podcast, visit us on the web at dailyplastic.com where you can leave a comment, or call us at 415-287-4020. This is a way for you to record your comments, and we'll hear your voice. You don't have to talk to anybody when you do it, but we would actually really love to hear what you have to say. We'll see you next time. Bye.